stay tuned for Straight Talk, the show where social justice meets criminal law. Brought to you on WPVC, the progressive voice of Charlottesville, by Tucker Griffin Barnes. Now here's your host, Andre Hakes.
Good morning, Charlottesville. You are listening to Straight Talk on WPVC-FM, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. Straight Talk is a series of interviews and conversations about legal and social justice issues affecting our community. I am your host, Andre Hakes. On today's show, we'll be talking with John Zug, who some of you may know as the recently elected clerk of the Albemarle County Circuit Court, and who is also a veteran prosecutor with particular experience with domestic violence cases. Welcome, John.
Good to see you, Andre. How you been?
I have been just great. It's great to have you on the show.
And I am pleased to be here.
I have known you for years and years and years. But there might be, someone out there who doesn't know you listening to our show. So tell me a little bit. There's an off chance. tell me a little bit about your background. Where'd you go to school and sort of how you ended up being a prosecutor?
Well, I graduated from high school up in Arlington at W&L High School, moved on to Hampton, Sydney, actually, for a couple years till the money ran out, and Dad said that either I could go into debt or I could go to a state-supported school. Ended up transferring to James Madison University, where I graduated with a Bachelor of Science. And
JMU works?
Oh, yeah, no, I love JMU. It's always a fun trip over to Harrisonburg. And then got into law school at George Mason University School of Law and went to law school up in Arlington, where I originally grew up.
You're a Nova boy.
I am, yes.
Gotcha. Well, that's cool. So you went to law school at George Mason, and then what did you want to do when you were in law school? Did you think, gosh, I want to be a big corporate stuffed shirt, or gosh, I want to be a prosecutor, or gosh, I want to be, what did you think you were going to do?
Well, so I'm one of that rare breed. When I went to law school, I knew I wanted to be a prosecutor. I had had a girlfriend whose sister, while I was just starting college, was graduating from Baltimore School of Law, and she was in the Baltimore State's Attorney's Office, and she told the best stories, often the funniest stories, and I thought, I'd really like to do that. And so I knew and held out until I could get a prosecutor's job.
There are a lot of funny stories in this business.
Oh, there are a ton.
Some of them we can't tell, but they're very funny. A few of them we can. So when I went to law school, I remember I thought that what lawyers did was put people in jail and keep people out of jail. That was my idea of what lawyers did. And I remember going to law school and sitting there my first year of law school in torts class going, what are we doing? What? And it didn't occur to me that, this is going to seem funny, it didn't occur to me that there were prosecutors and defense attorneys. I just thought they were criminal lawyers. Right. So I wanted to be a criminal lawyer. But then, of course, my liberal bent took over and, you know.
Well, you prosecuted for a little while, didn't you?
I prosecuted for a hot minute. What happened was UVA had a third-year practice rule program where, and I know you know about this because your office has interns, right, where you could do, if you could join the prosecution clinic or the defense clinic. And my girlfriend at the time, who was the only law student person I ever dated, was in the prosecution clinic. And she was significantly more savvy than I about how law school worked. She educated me that if I did the prosecution clinic, I could try multiple cases every week. Whereas if I did the defense clinic, I was maybe going to get to try one case that year or that semester. And I was like, well, okay then. So I did end up in the prosecution clinic, and I prosecuted a whole bunch of very serious offenses like reckless driving and, you know, all trespass.
Dog cases that they decided to hand down
right.
to you.
No, they were kind to me. They were. It was I was out in Fluvanna with Frank Gallo for a semester, and then he lost the election. Colin Guy was the guy who beat him, and Colin is passed away now. But I didn't have anything against Colin, but I didn't want to work with him because it was such a bitter
election. Oh yeah, that was
election, I was very loyal to Frank, so I went to Louisa because Frank's buddy Don Short was working there. That was when Susan Whitlock was the Commonwealth,
right?
And so I did my second semester out there. So I prosecuted in Fluvanna and Louisa.
Nothing wrong with those locations,
of all things. I liked it. It was kind of fun. It was fun to try cases, but
You are so good at defense work. You've got your niche. You're right where you should be.
Yeah, I think I'll stay over here. I don't think I'll quit the day job anytime soon. But thank you for that. So you know, I think you were already prosecuting in Charlottesville when I graduated law school and started prosecuting.
Yeah, so I started in 1988. Richard Barrick is the Commonwealth attorney who hired me. Started January 1st, 1988, and literally prosecuted just up until, what, the day before yesterday when the year ended and I took over my mantle as clerk of court. I've worked in a number of different offices, worked obviously in Charlottesville on two separate occasions. In the middle, I worked in Norfolk on the violent crime unit, and then, of course, worked for the County of Albemarle for the last 9 years.
So you practiced, you prosecuted under Dick Barrick, you prosecuted under Dave Chapman.
Yep.
You
prosecuted Steve Deaton.
Steve Deaton.
Forgot
Steve
about
Deaton.
Steve
Deaton was the first guest on my show.
Yeah, Steve, when Mr. Barrick stepped down, Steve took over, had one term before he was beat by Dave Chapman.
Gotcha. And then, of course, Denise Lunsford. Did you prosecute under Jim Campbell also?
I was. I was hired by Jim Campbell. And so I was hired in July of 2006, so the last year and a half that Jim was Commonwealth attorney, I worked for him.
Gotcha. But you're going to miss Robert Tracy.
Well, I am. I mean, that's because I've been elected, and so I've got another gig I got to go to.
I guess you'll be seeing him a fair amount anyway.
Yeah, no, I look forward to working with him. I mean, the whole point is for me to make the clerk's office better, and I'm hope obviously I help by making the Commonwealth Attorney's Office better. I make my own office better.
Excellent. So tell me a little bit about how you ended up in JDR court. I mean, most of my experience with you, I've tried all kinds of cases with you, John, but a lot of my experience with you has been in JDR court, where I am probably least comfortable of all the courts.
And, you know, I think all of us are least comfortable there, and it's kind of nice to get a little bit... Well, it's
I
good
think
to
I
get,
know why me, but...
But it's good to get out of our comfort zone. So, I mean, the reason was I get into domestic violence. And, by the way, my entire career is not in domestic violence. I mean, I worked as a prosecutor for 28 years. It's really only the last 17 years where the focus is on domestic violence. The very last homicide case that I handled in Norfolk was a husband shooting and killing his wife. We ended up getting a conviction only for manslaughter when, mm-hmm. in the minds of myself and my co-counsel, it was clearly murder. And I began to think that this is something I need to spend more time on. And at the time, the General Assembly had approved all of these juvenile and domestic relations or domestic violence prosecutor positions. And so when I came back to Charlottesville and was hired back by Dave Chapman, I wanted that role. And mm-hmm. I took it and found out how steep my learning curve really was going to be. Because the fact is that while I had had a case of domestic violence homicide, I didn't know the first thing about domestic violence.
The JDR court, I don't know my history that well. I've only been practicing here since 96. 96 is when I graduated law school.
Mm-hmm.
And I started defending cases right away, and some of them were in Charlottesville and some of them were in Albemarle. But the my inkling is that the JDR court didn't always exist. Did it used to be just a district court, or?
So I don't know the answer to that question. I will tell you, JNDR court has existed as a joint city county JNDR court since I came to Charlottesville. I recall when I was in the prosecution clinic up in Arlington, there was a JDR court there, had three different judges. Arlington, obviously, significantly bigger. We share it here. I want to say that JNDR was an outcropping in the 1970s when there was a significant push to change the manner in which juvenile justice was handled and to focus more on rehabilitation.
You think the impetus for the JDR court's creation was juvenile justice more so than domestic violence?
Absolutely.
It was sort of a family court to handle, and it was mostly juveniles. That makes sense. I started practicing, like I said, in 96. I heard, you know, you hear all these stories. I heard all these stories about women who were victims of domestic violence and sexual assault were mistreated in the courts, and the sort of the boys would be boys mentality of the court system. But that's never been my experience. Now, I'm defense, right? So, you know, I'm defending the boys most of the time. Occasionally the girls, but mostly the boys.
Yep.
But it has seemed to me that the courts and the legislature are very solicitous of victims' rights. And I'm wondering if that has always been the case, or if in the time that you practiced, you saw that change.
Well, so what happens...
Or if you disagree.
No, I absolutely agree with you. And it wasn't just the court system. It was literally society as a whole. The fact is if you look at a police training video from the 60s and in through the 70s, you would watch that and as how they handled those cases and go, oh my gosh. I mean, the training video I saw from the 1960s showed the police officer asking what it was that she had done that caused him to be so angry.
Really?
Oh, absolutely.
And then what was, I could envision a police officer asking that question now in a sort of a Reed method of interrogation way of getting him to admit he whapped her.
No, I'm talking about the comment to the woman. Was mm-hmm. what had you done to make him so angry?
What did you do to make your husband so
mad? Yes, what did you do to make your husband so mad? And I mean that is hardly a victim-centered.
No.
It wasn't so much boys were boys as this was a family matter and we shouldn't be involved.
I see.
And arresting on domestic violence ended up being as a matter of last resort. If I have to come out here again, one or the other of you is going to go to jail.
Sort of the don't make me come up there.
That's exactly
kind of,
right.
Right.
And that handling, ultimately in the long run, ends up being harmful to the victim of domestic violence.
How long did that last? When did that start to change, or do you know?
Yes. So, well, it changed first in Minnesota and Massachusetts, and that would have occurred in the early 80s.
Okay.
And they started moving, and it took them until about 90 till they'd really kind of hammered things out. And they actually have domestic violence courts. And
Massachusetts, I can kind of see, but Minnesota?
Oh yeah, the Duluth model. Model is the whole power and control wheel. Minnesota has always been at the forefront with regard to how we handle domestic violence. And by the way, we keep using this term domestic violence, and it's really we are evolving. It is the wrong term.
Okay. What is the right term?
So it's now going to be called IPV as opposed to DV for intimate partner violence. Because it's not just domestic situations, it's who your intimate partner is. And that doesn't mean we're going to change.
In other words, like hookup violence would be included in IPV, yeah. Whereas it wouldn't be included in domestic
violence? Right. Now, we still aren't going to be trying that in JNDR court, Juvenile Domestic Relations Court, but they are looking at a much broader, more encompassing view of intimate partner violence, and that's kind of where I think that you're going to see things headed. Maybe not jurisdictionally, but certainly in the manner of the approach to this type of violence.
So this started to change in the early 80s.
Yep.
In Minnesota and Massachusetts.
Yeah.
And then how long did it take to get to Virginia?
A long time. So the problem is that you suffered from having graduated from law school in 1996. And the big
change... And oh, did I suffer.
Yeah, and the big change in DV, IPV in Virginia was 1997. July 1st, 1997, we got mandatory arrest. They increased the protections under protective orders. And that's when it really started here in Virginia.
You are listening to Straight Talk on WPVC. I'm Andre Hakes, and this is my guest, John Zug, who is a veteran prosecutor of IPV cases. I'm going to try to adopt that, but probably won't for today.
Now, and don't worry about it, because, Andre, I'm going to keep saying DV, too.
Yeah.
I haven't quite picked up on it yet.
We'll get
myself.
There. We'll get there. So that happened in 97 when the mandatory arrest happened, and that was kind of the big change. I have seen, I'm aware of a number of different kinds of special laws that govern domestic violence type cases. And so I'm going to just sort of run through them, and I want you to explain to people what they are.
Okay.
Talk about the rape shield statute. What is the rape shield law?
So what happened is in rape cases, historically is that what you did was you attacked the character of the victim by going into her past history, particularly that she was a person not of chaste behavior.
Not of chaste moral character.
That's right.
Wasn't there actually a statute in Virginia at some point that talked about, you know, women of chaste moral character? It was a crime to impugn the virtue of a woman of chaste moral character?
Certainly was, and probably up until
probably
the 50s
still,
or 60s, and it may still be there.
On
the books. Nobody enforces it, of course. And the whole context or the whole reason behind the rape shield law was so that it just can't be some smear campaign and go into the past sexual history of the victim. That way, what we're doing is we're trying the offense as opposed to just saying that this person isn't worthy of
it. So you don't basically get to say she's a hoe, so it doesn't matter.
That's exactly right.
Right. Okay.
And that actually dates back to the late 70s.
Okay. Let's talk about strangulation, the new strangulation statute. Maybe it's not really new, but relatively new.
So about 2.5 years now.
What is it?
So that's if you impede the blood circulation or respiratory of a woman or a man by either manually or by use of a device such that they can't breathe and it causes injury to them. That's a Class 6 felony now.
Yeah, so did this come out of domestic violence cases where, you know, you'd be normally charging somebody with assault and battery, but they choked their spouse or partner, and so then we decided to up the ante on that in the legislature?
Absolutely, and I don't want to be a stickler, but you choke on a piece of food. But when somebody's manually cutting off your air supply or blood supply, that's a strangulation.
Okay.
And so, but that absolutely.
But you know what I mean.
Domestic violence was the impetus for all of that.
I gotcha. And how have you seen that play out in the time that it's been adopted?
So we've had a number of cases in the last 2.5 years in the county of Albemarle. I can't speak too much for the other jurisdictions. It's been a mixed review. We've had convictions. We've had more acquittals in jury trials than I think convictions. But the convictions that we've had have not resulted in what I would call strong sentences. The one that comes to mind is one that Corrine Walker tried, and the jury, after convicting this guy of the strangulation, gave a $2,500 fine.
Wow, okay. Well, is that because the statute covers more things than you think of wrapping your hands around somebody's neck and cutting off their air supply until they pass out? I mean, does it cover your hand touched their neck at some point and you momentarily couldn't breathe?
No, the statute requires a little more than that. It does require bodily injury. So one of the things that we're having to prove on those matters is that the person has difficulty swallowing or talking, or that they're hoarse after for several days thereafter. Just briefly doing it and with no resulting injury is not going to result in that charge. And I've actually had that where the person's
really?
Been... Oh, yeah. No, we've had cases where the person's been choked and then the police on their follow-up. So, are you having any difficulty swallowing? What you're talking... Is there some change in their voice? And it haven't happened. And I've said, you know, we can't charge.
I mean, can't charge because we don't have injury.
Yeah, you have to have injury.
But injury can be pretty mild, can it? I mean, there's redness.
There's absolutely.
Injury. We have injury if you have redness.
Yep. And the fact is, though... you're right. We do use it quite a bit and have used it quite a bit, but there have been a number of cases where I've had to say, no, can't go forward on this.
Isn't that kind of one of those areas of prosecutorial discretion?
Yeah, and what you hope is that you've got a prosecutor
who exercises some.
Actually exercising it, yeah.
Yeah, but if you wanted to prosecute a momentary, you know, he put his hand on my neck, it was red.
Yo, know, absolutely. No,
half
no,
a second.
You can do it. You can certainly do it.
What about victim witness folks? Tell me about the victim witness program and how that started and when and what those people do.
So the victim witness programs come into being in the late 80s, very early 90s. It's interesting. Only the last few offices have finally actually accepted within the last 5 years having a victim witness program.
You mean there were jurisdictions in Virginia that have refused to have a victim witness advocate?
Yeah, including in our 16th Judicial Circuit, but I will let that jurisdiction go unnamed.
Ooh. Ooh, okay.
So, yeah,
all right.
I don't want to call anybody out, either past Commonwealth attorney or otherwise. But,
I hear you.
It all depends on the view. And the fact is I've always found victim witness to be a partner to the prosecutor's office or the police department.
Mm-hmm.
It's one of the reasons why, you know, you talk about me in terms of my work with domestic violence. I will tell you, I'm nothing without the people I work with. And the team approach that we have with our domestic violence services providers and with victim witness is the reason I have been
effective.
What
do the victim witness people do? They're not attorneys.
Nope, they're not attorneys. They're there to actually basically walk victims and witnesses through the criminal justice process. They're there to help advise them of what's going to happen if there's a continuance, helping excuse them as well. They also provide them, if somebody's been injured, with access to the Criminal Injuries Compensation Fund. Both Sandy Abbott and Susan Painter, who are in the Victim Witness Program here in Albemarle, work real hard to link people into services and get them hooked up, so that what we're able to do is reduce as much as we can the double victimization that happens when you go through the criminal justice system.
Gotcha. All right. Well, we are going to take a brief break here, and we'll be right back with John Zug.
This week on Straight Talk, Deputy Commonwealth. This week on Straight Talk, Deputy Commonwealth's Attorney for Chesterfield and erstwhile Deputy Attorney General of Virginia under the Cuccinelli administration.
Love me like she does.
With Straight Talk. My guest is John Zug, and we are talking about domestic violence cases. John is a veteran prosecutor of domestic violence who is now the clerk of the Albemarle County Circuit Court.
Yep.
So, John, I want to take you back just a couple
this
of months.
This week on Straight Talk
to the Commonwealth Attorney's race in Albemarle County. There was a show that we did where Denise Lunsford was here and Robert Tracy was here, and we had lots of call-ins on that one. And they were sort of having a little debate, right?
You know. Yes.
And
I listened to that podcast. I did not get to hear it live.
Did you?
Yeah.
So there was a debate question that came in. There's a lady named JoJo Robertson. Hi, JoJo. Who was strongly in support of Denise. And she called up on the phone, and she said, "How many women lie about being raped?" And at that moment, I felt sort of bad for Robert. Not quite as bad as I felt for Denise when the crazy lady called later and started kind of jumping on her personal life, but momentarily bad.
Yep.
And I thought to myself, I'm not really sure how you answer that question, but there probably are some statistics on it somewhere, and if anybody knows what those statistics are, I bet it's John Zug.
Yeah, I wish I could tell you I know what the statistics are, but I will tell you the number is going to be really small.
Okay.
You know, and let's talk about that. The fact is that if you report a rape, the one thing that you're going to have to do is you're going to have to talk about something that is intensely private and intensely humiliating, and you're going to have to do it to complete strangers.
Mm-hmm.
And people don't really understand how difficult that is to do. To sit there and talk about what may have been the worst experience of your life to probably a man, because most police officers are men and most rape victims are women. To talk about that to somebody you don't know is almost paralyzing. And so you then have to tell the prosecutor. You're going to have to tell at least one judge, probably two or three judges. If it goes to a jury, you're going to have to tell 12 complete strangers. And I have to ask, who the hell wants to go through that?
Well, if it didn't happen, it's not quite the same, is it?
Well, no. The fact is, you know, Aristotle's the one who said that that nobody has a good enough memory to be a great liar. And the fact is we remember things because we process them through our senses. That's how it gets imprinted into our mind. And if you're going to tell a lie, something that didn't happen, you are going to have to do what actors do, which is rehearse over and over and over again. And it's difficult.
Well, at least if you have a decent defense attorney who's going to cross-examine you
in front of
a judge who's got some critical thinking skills, or a jury.
That's right. That's exactly right. But, you know, it's that glare. And you actually find the people who it didn't happen to start backing up real quickly when they're finding that they're getting exposed to that, and all of a sudden coming to me as the prosecutor and saying, you know what, I don't want to go through this.
How do you decide? The question that sort of came to me in light of this question of JoJo Robertson's was, you know, how do you gather statistics on that? How do you decide whether or not an allegation is true? I mean, do you base it on, if you were going to statistically try to figure this out, would you base it on convictions? Would you base it on retractions? People retract who retract for another reason. They just don't want to go through being cross-examined because, as you said, it's a horrific process.
Yeah, I think it has to be actually self-reporting. You know what? I said this and it wasn't true.
Ah, I don't think that's going to give you a decent statistic. Who's going to admit that? Who, having made something like this up, is now going to go back and say, I lied, please prosecute me for perjury?
Oh, no. So it doesn't get done in the context of with law enforcement. It gets done in the context of research. So done through the university, through maybe a gender studies program and the like, talking to those people where there isn't that threat that they're going to be prosecuted for the lie.
That threat always exists, and B, you want someone who you're talking to think well of you. So if you've begun this lie, you're not going to want to back off of it. You're not going to want to say, it didn't happen. I mean, there might be a few people who say that.
Yeah.
But there must be false convictions because there are DNA exonerations in cases. So there must be people who put themselves through this whole process, and it's just not as horrific a process if you're making it up.
It's interesting, though. The false conviction ones end up being people who misidentified their assailant as opposed to the event didn't happen.
Sometimes. That's where you get the DNA evidence, and
right.
That's why that's the case, right? Because if you have the DNA, you can make the exoneration.
Right.
But we don't have a way to know how many people it just didn't happen.
That is true.
Yeah, it's just sort of a hard thing to figure out statistically, I think.
I agree. And, you know, and people, to some extent, demand perfection from their criminal justice system. And the fact is
they're never going to get it.
Yeah, they're not going to get it. I mean, it's beyond a reasonable doubt is the burden for the prosecution. But the fact is that we do make mistakes. I mean, it's a human system, and all of us have our human foibles, and so there will be mistakes at time.
That is true. So another thing I want to talk about, and this comes from my, you know, defense lawyer perspective, right?
Mm-hmm, sure.
Is the sort of idea about believing the victim. Here was something that I observed when the Rolling Stone case happened, when the article came out. This article comes out about this fraternity gang rape story, and I happened to have a rape trial coming up.
Mm-hmm.
Right when that article
came
out.
Yeah, you did. That's
and
right.
I was like, oh, man, you know, people were going to candlelight vigils. They were posting crazy kind of vitriolic stuff about how UVA was this old boy network and everything. And I remember seeing some posts, because I was looking at the social media at the time. I was like, oh, man, what is my jury?
Yeah, weren't you thinking about continuing your case?
Well, yeah, I was. I think I tried to continue it, although that was also the both the prosecutrix and the victim in that case were pregnant at the time the case went
yep,
to trial.
That's right,
and
that's
I was
right.
Like, oh, man, this is just
a double whammy.
Bad, bad visuals for the trial. I remember seeing some posts saying things like, you know, you believe the victim. It's really important to believe the victim. You must believe the victim. You know, that sort of implied that, the truth of what happened wasn't really as important as believing the victim.
Yes.
And I found that horrifying. And while I understand that it's tough for somebody, horribly tough for somebody who has suffered a violation like a rape to come forward, and I understand how a therapeutic relationship, say with a counselor or someone, you might need to believe them. You might be required in order for the therapy to take. It seems to me that it's not always appropriate in the legal field, and there might ought to be some other considerations.
Yep.
What do you think about that?
No, I agree with you.
How do you balance that as a prosecutor with, you know, your job?
So that's tough. I mean, one of the things that I felt that made me a good prosecutor is that I was able to think as a defense attorney. I was able to look for the weaknesses in my case. You know, Andre, we all have our gifts. I felt one of my best gifts was being able to pick up a case file, read a case file, and see the weaknesses, really evaluate
kind
that
of
case.
Know what I was going to come at you with.
Right. And to evaluate that case for its strengths and its weaknesses.
Right.
You know, my view in any case, particularly a sexual assault case, is that if I had a 50-50 shot, I would roll the dice. If the victim wanted to go forward, I would go forward, absent there being something glaring going on that said otherwise. And I'll give you an example.
Okay.
So it would have been in 1989 or 1990, we had this case where it was actually the abduction, and I'm going to put it in air quotes.
Air quotes. You can't see the air quotes, but they're there.
The abduction occurred in the city.
Uh-huh.
The rape,
in quotes,
also in air quotes, occurred in the county.
Okay.
Scott Goodman was representing the defendant. I wish I could remember his name, and I don't remember the name of the victim. And she'd come in and reported this, and Scott, after preliminary hearing, and I got my first whiff at preliminary hearing that something is fishy in Denmark, and based on the way that Scott cross-examined. And it became clear during Scott's cross-examination at preliminary hearing that the defense here was going to be is this was actually a prostitution where the prostitute didn't get paid, and now she's crying rape.
Oh,
right. It was one of those. And Scott agreed, and this was very rare, agreed that what we would do is we could try it jointly either in the county or the city, and we ultimately elected to try it in the city. For both charges, so that we only had to have one trial as opposed to separating them out.
Right.
And both me and Lindsay Dorier agreed that that would be appropriate.
Lindsay Dorier was the prosecutor at the time?
He was Commonwealth attorney at that time.
When does that put this case? That was a long time ago, wasn't it?
I said 1989 or 1990, is when this case was. And so I began to have my first, there's something going on here. And then what happens is...
I'm guessing that the victim did not come to you and say, hey, I'm a prostitute.
No, nothing along those lines.
No.
And then as I were heading towards trial, after preliminary hearing, the victim disappears.
Oh.
She falls off the map. I can't get a hold of her. I'm leaving messages with family and friends for her to get in touch with me. She won't do it.
Mm-hmm.
We get within 3 weeks of trial, and I can't find her, and she's not coming in. And the fact that I had left as many messages as I had, and everybody said, yes, I'll get it to her, she'll call you, and she's not calling me, that's a huge red flag to a prosecutor.
Yeah, that's a problem.
And I actually went to Lindsay and said, you know, we've got a problem with this case. We need to either talk about pleading it or do something else. Because at that time, I think Scott was willing to plead the rape down to a sexual battery, and we would
which is a misdemeanor,
right? And he wanted to drop. He wanted me to drop the abduction because he's saying this really never was an abduction. She went voluntarily out to the county, and I went, and Lindsay was not willing to do that. But he had not gone through the same preliminary hearing that I had, and he was not. Wasn't gearing up for trial the way that I was.
Did you take the transcript and hand it to him?
So we didn't have a transcript in those days because they weren't automatically recorded back in those days.
Oh, not good.
But, I mean, I had my notes, so I knew what the heck the score was.
Right.
And he wasn't willing to do it. And I actually went to Steve Deaton, my boss, and said, hey, Steve, I'm beginning to have some doubts about this case.
Right.
I think we need to do something. And ultimately, Steve was like, well, if the county wants to go forward, we need to go forward. And I remember that we end up going to trial on this, and it is the only case in my career that I can recall going through a trial with no faith in my case. And I really felt bad. I was so angry at the conclusion of the trial, having had to go through it, that I went back to Steve and said, don't ever put me in this position again.
Did the guy get acquitted?
He was. He
and
was acquitted on all
counts.
Did
she show up to trial?
She did. She ended up showing up 2 days before the trial, agreeing to meet with us. I confronted her
Did you ask her about it?
Oh, absolutely. I confronted her with, first off, you know, you're not meeting with me. This is what the defense is. And I asked her. And so I came out and I was like, so let me ask this. Did you offer to have sex with this man for money? And there was a pregnant pause before she answered no, and that really, really bothered me. And I'd gone back to Lindsay and said, "Look, I got to be perfectly honest. In my gut, I'm not comfortable with her. I'm not believing we're getting the whole story, and we need to talk about this." And he still wanted to go forward, and so I felt like I was put in a box. For me, as a young prosecutor, it was a learning experience. I will tell you, 5 years later from that, if somebody had said to me, you're going to handle this case, my response would have been, no, I'm not doing this.
Well, law is a funny place to be as an associate or an under prosecutor, because you have ethical obligations that you may view differently than your managing partner or your elected Commonwealth's attorney.
Yep.
And so it can be a very challenging place to be as a young attorney, particularly when you don't have a lot of experience and you don't kind of know how the game's played.
That is the case that taught me that that if I don't have faith in a case, I'm not going to handle it. I'm either going to null pros it, drop the charges, or what I'm going to tell the my supervisor in that situation is I'm not handling the case, and if your answer is you're going to handle it, then my response is going to be I'm going somewhere else because I'm not going to work under these circumstances. Mm-hmm. I'm not going to work under circumstances where if I cannot be convinced. And my problem in that case, and as a young lawyer, was the fact that while I didn't believe her, I didn't have a hook, a true hook that I could hang on that say, yes, I can prove she's lying.
Mm-hmm.
I can demonstrate that she's lying, and I didn't have that, and so I felt like I was in a box.
Right.
But, you know, with maturity, you get to the point where you're going, nope.
That doesn't smell good.
That doesn't smell good, and as a result of that, I'm not going to do this case,
right.
or I'm going to handle it in a different way. What I wanted to do was do the plea. I believe the plea would have been the best way. It would have been splitting the baby in Solomon's terms. But the fact is that it would have been better than how we ended up.
As a defense attorney, you have the same issue, only it's on an accelerated timeline. Your client comes in and they go, this is what happened. And you go, no, that's not what happened, right? Right? Only when you're a new attorney, you go, oh, okay. Right? And you go into court and you get wham, But as you get experience, you have that initial conversation. I remember I had a client once who I went, this is when I was maybe even practicing for 3 or 4 years.
Yep.
And I had a client. You develop these relationships with these guys, this client, he would tell me a story, and as he got into the story, I explained to him about the canaries in the coal mines. And I said, the miners used to bring these little canaries down in the mine with them. The canary would die if the toxic gases got too concentrated, right? And so, so periodically, I just tell him, I'd say, oh, that canary, he's looking a little peaked. Oh, wait, he's losing some feathers, right? He's sort of back up, Oh, no. Oh, he's got his feet up in the air, dude. That's not,
Well, Andre, you've come to learn that so what we've got is my victim is telling me one thing. Your defendant is telling you something. And you and I know that somewhere in between those two is the real truth.
Or somewhere not even in between those two. Somewhere totally on a different plane.
Yeah,
out
you're
here.
Right. It can be that far out. You're right.
Just depends.
My view, though, is it's where along that continuum between the two is it that the real truth is. And that's the thing that I think you and I, as you as a defense attorney, me as a prior prosecutor, have struggled with our entire career.
Yeah, although as a prosecutor, you have this ethical duty to seek justice, right? You're supposed to try to get it right. As a defense attorney, I've got a really simple duty, and my duty is to protect my client.
Yep, you're absolutely right.
So in some ways, it's freeing to be defense counsel, and I don't have to care where that line is or what actually happened.
But it's nice to have people like you out there, because I have to tell you, you helped me get to understand where on the continuum is, where I can feel comfortable what the truth is. That helps me get to that justice. That helps me get to the decision, am I going to make an offer in this case? Are we going to trial?
Mm.
And our last jury trial was one of those. You'll recall, you started talking to me about what it was that, and I realized what it was that your side was going to say, what evidence you were going to be able to deduce at trial, and that's why we ended up going to trial, but why I also made an offer in that case.
Yeah, you did make a decent offer, and it was a well-tried case.
It was a well-tried case.
It was lots of fun, I have to say.
I will say I was disappointed in the sentence, but not in the ultimate conviction.
Some trials are more fun than others.
Yes.
But I don't know. It's funny to say fun. I mean, it's fun for us. Might not be fun for the victim. Might not be fun for the client. Okay, so we need to take a break.
Okay.
My producer has handed me a little note that says break. So we'll be right back.
Straight Talk, 790 DC, progressive voice of Charlottesville, in addition to Tucker Griffin Barnes, our main sponsor, and now Wealthy Cavalier Reporting, is a locally owned and operated leader in providing professional deposition services to lawyers throughout Central Virginia. Along with covering legal matters of the private sector, Cavalier Reporting provides assistance to the SEC, the EEOC, the Department of Deaf and Hard of Hearing, and Virginia Department of Labor. Cavalier Reporting understands that deposition services must thus be delivered with consistency and accuracy every time. Now back to Straight Talk.
So, you are listening to Straight Talk. I'm Andre Hakes. My guest today is John Zug, who is a veteran prosecutor. Mostly, most of the career that I've known you in, John, you've been in Albemarle and Charlottesville.
Yep.
And you've been doing the criminal cases. I want to talk for a minute about something that in the last couple of years I've had some experience with, which is UVA sexual assault cases.
Yes.
These are their own creatures. What happens is a student, usually a female student at UVA, will report a rape by a male student at UVA, and there will proceed to be sometimes a dual process where there is a criminal justice process if the student, if the victim decides that she wants to prosecute criminally.
And it's important to know real quick that is actually all victim driven. In other words, if a victim does not wish to go forward with a case either in the city or the county, both offices have a policy. We're not going to force a victim to go to trial. I'm sorry I
right.
interrupted.
No,
but
no, I'm not
sure
sorry
you
interrupted.
That.
That's exactly the kind of thing that you know is important for people to understand. That is true, but these things are largely dependent on what the victim wants to do, or the complainant, as I sometimes call them.
Yes, complainant, right.
But
and then you said there's the university
well,
process.
Well, the what I have seen is there are these two procedures going on sometimes at the same time. UVA does a very thorough investigation in these cases. The police department does a standard investigation like they always do. The UVA investigations mm-hmm. seem to have ridiculous amounts of detail in them. And the sometimes you've got somebody who's got a criminal charge and they're also charged it in the UVA process and they can't make statements in one without jeopardizing themselves in the other.
That's actually true for the victim, too, because I will tell you the judiciary process sometimes can harm the prosecution. So
really?
Oh, yeah. Makes us go forward with something when we're not quite ready. We haven't gathered all of the facts.
Why? I mean, can't you just sit on it in the criminal system and wait for the UVA process to play itself out?
Well, I wish that was often the case. The problem is if we've charged somebody, we're going to have constraints of time under speedy trial.
Well, sure, but I mean, you don't have to charge them, right? Can't you just sort of wait and...
Usually, it's the charging decision there that drives what happens in the judiciary process. I tend to have... My experience has been is that the charge comes first, and then... And when I say the charge, I mean the criminal charge that starts in the state system has come first, and then the judiciary process kind of tends to start thereafter. But you may have a totally different experience.
That's not necessarily been my experience. I've had a few of them in the past couple years. Maybe one of them was like that. But what I have seen is there's a system at UVA called Just Report It, right? You get online and you say, you know, I was raped. Here's what happened, right? And then the next day you're in the dean's office, right, having a conversation with someone, and they're talking to you about whether or not you want to report this to the police, right? There's usually, I think, a UVA police officer there for that conversation, but they don't necessarily file a a formal report.
Yeah, it's probably their victim witness advocate who's actually a sworn officer on UVA's police force. That's Ben Rexroad right
yeah,
now.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I think I recognize that name. And then they, you know, and then they decide whether or not to bring the criminal charge. But the thing that I sort of want to talk about these UVA cases because I'm very bothered by them. In particular, I'm very bothered by them because it seems to me that there is a lack of due process in the cases. Let me talk to you about what I'm seeing happening in the cases, and then I'd like your thoughts on it as a prosecutor.
Okay.
So, in the UVA process, there is a preponderance standard. This wasn't always the case. Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah. Yeah, preponderance standard. 50%.
Okay. Yep.
Right? 50-50. And in that process, things have changed over the years. They've evolved over the years.
Oh,
it didn't
yes,
used
they have.
To be. It used to be a clear and convincing standard.
That's right.
It's never beyond a reasonable doubt, which is the criminal standard, but it used to be clear and convincing. Now it's a 50-50, you know, 51% more likely than not, therefore you're guilty, or 49% you're not. The investigation happens. It's, as I said, very thorough. And then there's a report, and the draft report is sent to the defendant or to counsel. And the draft report has in it sort of a summary of the investigation. It's sort of like reading a long police report.
Okay.
Right? And it might be 50 pages long. But it doesn't say whether or not the person is responsible. And then you have an opportunity to file something to say, well, I think you need to talk to these three people, or I think you need to do this or read that, or, you know, sort of respond to it. And then after that, the final report is issued, and the final report says you are guilty. Okay, there's no hearing.
Not a hearing?
No, there's no hearing.
Okay. There used to be a hearing.
Okay. Now there's no hearing to begin with. The report just says, yep, you're responsible. Come on in and be sentenced. Would you like to accept responsibility, or would you like to, you know, just argue it, right? And when you say you want to argue it, it's an appeal. You're having an appeal of the finding that you're guilty that has just happened without a trial. When you get there to this appeal, there are usually a panel of judges who are UVA faculty staff, and they have been through some sort of training program. I don't know what the training program
is. The students
is.
Aren't involved in this anymore?
There are no students anymore who are sitting there. There are just faculty staff. And you have a right to an attorney, but the attorney is a paperweight. The attorney cannot talk during the hearing. I get to sit there.
Do you get to talk with your client?
I get to talk with my client privately. I can sort of whisper to my client.
Uh-huh. Okay, I got you.
And then, right, you know, but I sort of get to sit there next to my client, and I can't say anything. And then there's no right to cross-examine. Okay, so
that really hamstrings somebody like you.
No cross-examination, and I can't open my mouth. I mean, you know, I sit there and seethe, right? I seethe.
And I bet it's very visible.
It is so frustrating. But the way cross-examination happens, the crucible of truth-finding in this process is that the kid, or me, is supposed to write out questions to be asked by the hearing officer, right? And then the hearing officer asks them, right? Sometimes. Or the hearing officer decides they're not going to ask that question, right? And as you know, cross-examination requires sort of a setup and a series of follow-ups on the response. And so nothing like cross-examination happens in these hearings. And at the risk of losing my feminist club card, although I will never lose my lesbian toaster oven, you know, I think we might have gone a little too far here.
Let me ask, so this is all news to me. Is this all since the Rolling Stone case? Or does it precede? Does it precede?
Some of these changes precede. What happened was there was a... This all falls under the Office of Civil Rights. It's all Title IX, right? Okay, so OCR governs it, right? Yep. And at some point, there was a letter called the Guidance Letter that came out from OCR. And the Guidance Letter was a long document that basically said, you guys need to convict more boys of sexual assault. I mean, in my view, that's what the Guidance Letter said. It basically said, you know, you need to adopt different procedures. You know, these kids are getting away with this, and we need to see more of them thrown out. And one of the things, the biggest change is that guidance letter basically said, you know, you should be using a preponderance standard.
So that's why the switch.
That's why the standard was switched, right? But the hammer there, basically, I mean, I think the schools don't even want to do this. I'm sort of watching UVA in these hearings, right? And they're, you know, they're doing their thing, and these kids are getting convicted, and they're getting thrown out, and, you know, it's all happening. But there's a sense there.
Are they being
there.
Expelled, or are they being suspended?
Well, both. It depends. If you've got a rape case, if you've got some kind of allegation of a sexual assault, you're getting expelled most of the time.
Because... Then that's a recent development, because for the longest time that wasn't happening at all.
Yeah, I know that. I know that. That was part of the problem with the whole Rolling Stone thing, right?
Yep.
You know,
yep.
But the upshot of the Rolling Stone article, I mean, what kills me is the lady in the Rolling Stone article made this stuff up. Okay? This
well,
is not
I
true.
I will concur with you that what happens is that the Charlottesville Police Department does an investigation, and they basically say, we don't find what it was that was said in the article, and therefore what was told to the people at Rolling Stone.
Well, when the police don't find that somebody, that a crime has been committed, with the police with their bias, as much as I as defense counsel have my bias,
right?
You know, it's got to be pretty bad.
I would concur with
that. And the upshot of this is that we have this whole revamping of the college process, which denies these kids, in my opinion, any kind of due process. How do you protect yourself in that situation? You're already found guilty before you go, and then you sit there, and your lawyer can't speak, and you can't really cross-examine. And in the meantime, there's this criminal prosecution hanging out here. So if you even open your mouth, you have to surrender your Fifth Amendment privilege.
Right.
I think that's kind of tough.
So I think the solution to that, or a partial solution to that, is that one of the two has to be put on hold. Either the criminal prosecution, if that's going on concurrently. But I have to be perfectly honest. My general view is I believe that the criminal process should speak first.
It would make sense. Then the person would be able to avail themselves of Fifth Amendment privilege for the criminal process. And then if they wanted to say something in the UVA hearing when it's civil, then they could.
Yeah, I understand. I don't have any problem with the difference in the standard of proof.
Mm-hmm.
The consequence, the reason it's beyond a reasonable doubt, is we're talking about your liberty concerns.
It's true.
The preponderance of the evidence, it's, you know, just there's money involved. There is, in this particular case, it's whether or not you're going to stay in the school. So there's you're not going to lose your liberty. So I don't have any issues with regard to that. And it wouldn't bother me if they decided that it was clear and convincing evidence, but it doesn't bother me at all that it's a preponderance of the evidence. But it is troubling to me as a prosecutor who swore to uphold the Constitution that you're basically not getting the due process that you talk about.
And when you say that, what you mean is cross-examination, representation.
Oh no, it's more than just cross-examination. What you've described is you're really barely being able to put on any evidence.
Well, it's kind of a star chamber.
Right.
You can put on evidence, but it has to come out of your mouth. And
well, so the other thing that you talked about is with regard to, you know, you need to speak to these people. I mean, the whole concept behind you being able to put on a defense is you being able to direct that evidence. The fact that as the accused, you go, well, you need to talk to Fred Smith, Joe Brown, and Carlton Jones, you know, that's not the same as you as the advocate being able to go through that witness, talk with that witness. You know, you have no idea what it is that they're going to be asked. I mean, the concept of what you're talking about isn't just cross-examination. It's also about directing the questions that you have to the people. If I say, go talk with this person, and they don't go ask the right question, well, then how do you know that evidence ever came out? I mean...
Well, I could say to the investigators, go ask them these questions, right? And they might do it and they might not. It's kind of like saying to the police officer, you know, hey, you know, why don't you, usually I would say it to you and you would say it to the police officer, why don't you go ask this guy, blah, blah, blah.
Well, right, but that's what happened in our last trial. You said, hey, Dominic Zambrotta, the officer, mm-hmm. said, could you go do this? And I would go, hey, Dominic, go do this. And Dominic would go do that.
Right.
Right.
Sure.
So.
And you can do that here, but the problem is you don't have any control over how it comes out.
Well,
right?
The other thing, though, that you said, Andre, is that you can suggest questions, but then the court may not ask
them. That's exactly right.
And that is problematic.
That is right. And it's impossible to cross-examine that way because you can't follow up, right? And the person who's asking the question doesn't understand where you're going. And they're, you know, and they're so, you know, they're so touchy-feely about the victims in these cases now that they won't do any real cross-examination of them. And they're kind of hamstrung because OCR, I mean, the whole basis of that letter was, you know, we can't require you to do these things, but the subtext is, if you don't, we're going to take your Title IX funding, right? So,
right.
You know, UVA ends up doing this process, which I think lots of them know is ridiculous, but they end up kind of stuck in it. So,
yeah, I have to tell you, what you've described is not an experience I've ever had under the Virginia judiciary system when I've had sexual assault cases.
Well, no, it's not. It's nothing that would ever happen in court. But it is happening. It is happening right now. It is happening to kids in college. There's some federal cases coming down right now that are dealing with this. Somebody sued, I'm not going to remember which school it was. It was a private school, but it was a Virginia school. Mm-hmm. Somebody sued recently, and there was a Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals opinion on it, or a Fourth Circuit, it was a Fourth Circuit case, maybe it was a district court opinion, where they basically said, you know, this is a private school, so it's not a government actor, so we can't get into due process. But the sort of subtext of the opinion was, you did what? right? You know, so I'm sort of hopeful that eventually there'll be an opinion that will govern at least the public schools.
Well, you talk about the pendulum, and it happens. The pendulum swings back and forth. The unfortunate problem is the pendulum rarely seems to find the happy middle ground.
It doesn't stay there very long.
No,
as it swings back and forth, it passes through there for a fraction of a second.
And both of us, I think, have experienced that in terms of our level of frustration with various things going on over the course of our career.
So I want to talk with you just briefly. I don't have enough time. I'd like to talk to you a lot longer, but I'm going to talk to you briefly about some specific problems in DV cases or IPV cases.
Okay.
The biggest thing that I see when I watch you in court prosecuting these cases is I see that sometimes you've got a victim who is unwilling. You got a victim somebody who called the cops and said, my husband, boyfriend, partner, girlfriend, whoever, beat me up. And then by the time we get to trial, they don't want to go forward anymore.
That's right.
Why and how do you deal with that?
So that's tough. We deal with it. We have a very strict no-drop policy, both in the city and the county. What I believe is you called the police for a reason. You called the police because all of us call the police. We don't call the police because our cable went out. We don't call the police because
some of us do, but
because we lost our water service. We call the police because it's an effing emergency. That's why we call the police. What the information I get at the time, I believe that. The police officer doesn't go in and start making things up. What happens is by the time we get to court, the victim often sees there's some significant consequences to me calling the police. One, he got arrested. Two, he's now going to potentially be convicted. And so they don't want that to happen. What they wanted was to have the violence stop. And that's all they wanted. I want to not see them again. And so how I handle it is I try to be flexible in my handling of the case. One of the things that I do in particular is if somebody's eligible for the what's called the one bite at the apple, the finding under advisement under
first offender
18.2-57.3, I want that person to be able, because the concept of the batterer's intervention program is actually to reduce this type of situation from coming back.
Right. Sort of rehabilitative.
Absolutely.
Justice.
And so that's the carrot that I dangle out there for these type of cases to say, look, we're not looking to bury him under the jail. I try to get them to understand that you shouldn't be trying to protect them solely because there are some consequences, because the consequences may not be that bad. And what we're really trying to do is to prevent this from happening again.
And there we have it. Thank you, John.
Andre, it was
really
a pleasure.
Fun.
look forward to coming back sometime.
It's been more fun than many times we've faced each other across the room.
Absolutely.
So this has been Straight Talk. I'm Andre Hakes. Next week, we are going to be having Jim Cohen, a professor of psychology at the University of Virginia, who also has a neuroscience background. And we're going to be talking about the formation and corruption of memory, which is an area of importance to the legal field, particularly in regards to recovered memories and in regards to eyewitness testimony. I'm Andre Hakes, signing off for Straight Talk. Have a great weekend.
This has been Straight Talk with your host, Andre Hakes, brought to you by Tucker Griffin Barnes. Production is from Olivia August. Engineering, Mike Friend. Be sure and listen again next Saturday morning at 10 o'clock for Straight Talk on 94.7, the progressive voice of Charlottesville.